Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. My name is Molly McLaughlin, and I own a company that optimizes sleep through technology, accountability, and behavioral change. Each week, I'll be interviewing world-class experts ranging from doctors, innovators, and thought leaders to give actionable tips and strategies that you can implement to become a more skillful sleeper. Let's jump into your dose of practical sleep training. Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. My guest today is Ellen Viora. She's an MD and really this ancestral-minded psychiatrist, and she's going to help us explore the complicated relationship between mental health and sleep and what to do about it. So when we think about mental health and sleep, it can often be a real chicken and the egg type of question around what comes first, but either way, they are undeniably interconnected. And when my anxiety was at its highest, my sleep was consequently, in alignment with that, it was at its lowest. So what is so important about our guest is that she is a board-certified psychiatrist with degrees from Columbia and Yale and is challenging the status quo and taking a more functional medicine approach to mental health. So you're going to love what she has to say about sleep, sleeping pills, anti-anxiety medications, and your mood. But first, a little bit about her. So Ellen Viora, MD, graduated from Columbia University Medical School, received her BA in English from Yale University, and she's a board-certified psychiatrist, medical acupuncturist, and yoga teacher. Dr. Viora takes a functional medicine approach to mental health, considering the whole person and addressing imbalance at the root, rather than reflexively prescribing medication. In addition to her private practice, Dr. Viora is also a writer, speaker, and consultant for healthcare startups. And welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. Ellen, I am so grateful to have you here today, particularly following just getting home from a trip. I really appreciate you taking the time with all that.
Oh, Molly, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks.
Oh, it's awesome. Okay, so I know there's a lot of ground that we're going to want to cover today. And so I think it would make sense for us to start at the beginning and how it is that you got into your industry and really creating this new approach to mental health.
Yeah, it was an emergent phenomenon. But basically, I was a disenchanted med student and psychiatry resident, and the whole time felt like this one particular Beck lyric kept going through my mind, which is,
really?
I'm going to like butcher it, but if this town is crazy and nobody cares. That's how I felt in my medical training. It was like, something's just not right here. Like, I think that we're piling medications on, this is a very expensive and very clunky approach to health and healing, but I'm not sure people are really walking out of here thriving. And so I just felt in crisis and like, what did I just go into 6 figures of student debt for? What did I just give 10 years of my life and blood, sweat, and tears for? I'm feeling really like, I'm not sure I really know how to help people. So I went on and hoarded other trainings, and I basically studied Chinese medicine and acupuncture, functional medicine, Ayurveda. I became a yoga teacher and I studied nutrition, and I basically just acquired all of these other tools and these different approaches, like fundamentally different ways of looking at the health of the human body and how it heals, and created this grab bag of different things to reach for when I meet somebody. Someone walks into my office and I can think, okay, what's out of balance here? How can I help this person get back into balance?
Wow. Very out of the normal scope for the traditional path. And I love that you had the knowingness to do that. Of course, for this podcast called, you know, the Sleep as a Skill podcast, we're so obsessed over here with sleep. And how have you found sleep to play a role in this, and particularly the ability to pull from all of those tools that you were able to kind of gather and immerse yourself in when you're dealing with patients now that are coming in with difficulty around their sleep? What are some of the ways or some of the things that you think of that are maybe out of the normal approach that you pull into to help make a difference with that area around their sleep?
Yeah. So sleep is my absolute favorite thing to work on with patients. I think of it as eminently treatable. Mm. And it's really, as a psychiatrist, like it's at the bedrock of all of the conditions I treat. Like sleep There's sometimes a two-way street, like anxiety contributes to insomnia, insomnia contributes to anxiety. But
yes,
to me, that the sort of inlet is to start with fixing sleep, because as you say, it's a skill, it's fixable. And so with anxiety, depression, ADHD, especially adult ADHD, bipolar, it's huge. Like, this is such a fundamental path towards getting someone back into balance. It's, I think of it as a non-negotiable. Like, if you're not sleeping well, we will never really quite get there.
Oh, so true. I'm so grateful to meet someone with the similar enthusiasm around the difference that sleep can make. And do you feel it? So does that become one of your key, the part of your initial screenings with people, or not even screenings, but you know, the kind of download of what you're getting a sense of where the patient is at, then understanding their sleep habits? Is that one of the foundational places that you begin?
Oh yeah. No, nobody gets out of my office without like a full conversation about sleep. I remember when I used to work at a pretty conventional primary care setting, I was treating a lot of adult ADHD, and people were getting an earful about the impact that sleep has on adult ADHD. And they're like, can you please just give me my Adderall?
It's like, I love that.
But yeah, to answer one of your earlier questions, like the way, maybe the overarching idea of how I think about sleep is that the system is supposed to work. Like, our bodies know how to sleep. They want to sleep. It's yes. generally supposed to work. There are a few scenarios where I think that it's kind of part of the design or the lack of the design that sleep, it goes by the wayside. I think of menopause as one of those issues.
Sure.
And then, you know, in sort of more modern life issues like jet lag, which is still modifiable, and shift labor are some of the things that I find really difficult to fix. But apart from that, to me, everything else is just about reconciling what aspect of modern life is getting in the way of your body sleeping. And it usually is just that. It's just something about the way our modern environment differs from how we evolved. And we really, our DNA co-evolved with a natural setting where it was bright light outside during the day and darkness at night. And this is just the design of our body. I actually think it's a really good design. Like, I think they sat around in the boardroom of evolution and they're like, how are we going to make the humans sleep at night and feel awake during the day? And they're all scratching their heads. And somebody was like, ooh, I know. Let's use light. Light will cue the circadian rhythm. And when it's light out, they'll feel awake. And when it's dark, they'll feel tired. And I feel like they all had a like standing ovation for that. It's a brilliant design. And I don't blame them for not anticipating that we were going to invent electricity and eventually the iPhone and eventually Tiger King. And like, all of these things are going to get in the way of the way that light cues our circadian rhythm.
What? The boardroom of evolution. I love that. I have not heard that described in that way. And I absolutely think that is fantastic. And particularly that you have such a connection, or the knowing around that importance of light, and then the willingness to share that with your patients is just so out of the realm of, you know, some of the traditional methods that I've heard addressed, you know, on the doctor-patient kind of phenomenon in as it relates to mental health. So, wow. Okay. And then how is it that you got so connected to the importance of this? Was this from your own kind of personal connection to the difference that that makes, or in researching this more? Because certainly not every doctor is as attuned to this. So what made you different there?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I really know. I think that I've always been, without the vocabulary for it, just like the way that I think has always been an ancestral mindset. So basically thinking like the body is generally a decent design, like call it B plus A minus design. And it kind of works. And like, maybe we have bad knees and maybe menopause is a little bit of like a problematic issue, but like overall, it's a pretty good design that's been tweaked and finely tuned over the millennia. And so when something's really wrong, I like to think, what is the root cause here? I sort of take for granted that things are supposed to work. So what is out of balance? And the ancestral perspective is really just thinking like, in what ways are we living in 2020 in a way that's just so different from what our genes have evolved to expect? And so with sleep, that's a no-brainer, because like when it comes to our circadian rhythm and our everything that goes into sleep, it's like it couldn't be more out of step with how we evolved. And so that's where like all it draws on so many different aspects of what our bodies like to have to create good sleep, but definitely it starts with light.
Oh, So great. Okay. So then number one, I love that you have this ancestral mindset. I completely relate to that. And that's a big guiding principle here at Sleep as a Skill. So really, really cool that you bring that into your practice. Now, when you're dealing with different clients and they've had some of these persistent experiences, relationship to their sleep, how are you dealing, you know, when you see different people that are struggling? I know there's different camps, of course, when it relates to ways that they've been treating it or trying to treat it in the past. So say they're coming in and they've had prescription medications for sleep. And then, of course, the camp that just has been struggling without going into that. But tackling first the prescription medication around sleep. What are some of the first things that you do to address that or to help educate people around what that might be doing to their sleep and creating possible futures around what they can do with that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, meds.
Yes.
So,
agreed.
You don't want to just like talk about caffeine and magnesium. It's so fun. Okay, so we can talk about meds. So, so the way I think about sleep aids is, you know, it flies in the face of that I think the system's supposed to work. So it sort of gives up on the idea of getting it to work from a root cause resolution approach. And then all of these meds, psych meds, you know, they really kind of fix one problem in a very heavy-handed way and create other downstream issues. Yeah. So when I think about the different sleep aids, and I want to be like very sensitive to like anybody right now who's listening, who's probably, you know, has some relationship to sleep meds, I think that, you know, listen and know that there's no pressure here. There's certainly no shame here.
Absolutely.
And that like your path will take the circuitous route it needs to take. And so if you're right now taking meds nightly and you can't envision the horror show that would be to not take your meds and toss and turn all night, like I'm not saying you have to do that. It's, we don't have to rip the Band-Aid off. It's more just that I want to open people's eyes, sort of give you the informed consent that you probably didn't get with that first prescription. Mm. And then we'll round out with the conversation of like, but here's what you can do instead to make this all work. But meds, you know, there's a couple of main categories, and a lot of people are actually prescribed benzodiazepines for sleep, which are not really appropriate sleep aids, but they kind of do the trick, at least getting people to sleep and quieting the tossing and turning kind of panic feeling a lot of us can have when trying to fall asleep. And so benzos are things like Klonopin and Xanax and Ativan and Valium. And the way they are problematic, it's a lot of ways. They're habit forming, i.e. addictive. And they also, I find, exacerbate the exact problem they're trying to solve.
Yes.
So initially what they do is they give you a GABA experience. That's the neurotransmitter that's at play here. And GABA is a lovely experience. That's our neurotransmitter equivalent of feeling okay. Like that's how we feel calm and okay. Things are okay. I'm going to sleep. And it's sort of an endangered species of modern life for a variety of reasons. But so a glass of wine or a pill of Xanax will both give you a rush of GABA in your brain, and it can make you fall asleep. But our body is really wired for homeostasis, meaning getting back into balance. And so when it sees this big rush of GABA, it thinks, this feels awesome. But it also thinks, this might be risky. Because if a leopard were to come around the corner, we would be too buzzed or chilled out to care. So this is not a safe state to be in. So to reclaim homeostasis, the body starts to pull GABA receptors. So now what you're left with is you might even have normal GABA signaling, but it's almost like your brain can't hear the GABA because you don't have enough receptors. Mm. So even though that first pill of GABA or the first pill of Xanax is a really nice feeling, over time, cumulatively, this actually creates more insomnia, more irritability, more anxiety, more panic, more depression, more discomfort, just that crawling out of your skin feeling because your brain just can't hear GABA adequately. And that's not a state I wish on my worst enemy.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree with that. And you know, I relate to what you said too about like, can't we just talk about the magnesium and the caffeine?
Keep it light.
Yes, no, totally. And you know, it's just so fascinating, the number, particularly I'll have some clients that will come in and they're post-retirement. You know, they're in their 60s, 70s, and they have been taking this kind of low dose of Xanax for years and years for their sleep. And it seems to be getting progressively worse. And when certainly I loved how you spoke to maybe they didn't get that proper full sign off of what it was that they were getting themselves into with that. But it becomes this thing where then it doesn't even seem like there's that possibility for them of being without it. And I hear you on just that extreme or just the difficulty that is to withdraw and how much, or just to not be on it and how much goes into all that. So thank you so much for kind of explaining that and walking us through that. And so when you do have clients that come in, there's of course multiple different paths, and this is more in depth than, you know, a quick podcast conversation, but it sounds as if at least you can provide that level of possibility that that's something that people could be without and what that might be doing to their sleep.
Totally. Yeah. And like I compulsively sort of need to round out that like it's not just benzos, right? We also have Ambien and Sonata and Lunesta. Yes. And Trazodone and sometimes Seroquel and things like that. And they're not all quite as straightforward of a GABA story as the benzodiazepines, but all to their own, in their own ways, don't necessarily give us deep restorative sleep, sometimes create the conditions. They sort of create the need for themselves. Ambien has all of its own whole host of like unsavory side effects, like that you might wake up in the middle of the night and sleepwalk and sleep eat and get into more likely a traffic fatality the next day. Like there's just a lot of reasons to not get involved. And then sometimes people find themselves really stuck. Like they're not even necessarily sleeping that well on these meds or waking up feeling rested. But then if they don't take them, it's just worse. So it's like, you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. And so it's wonderful when we can intervene before meds get started and fix the problem at the root and then never even go down that path. But like, I'll sort of say again, for anybody listening who's feeling really demoralized right now, hearing that because you're on meds, like there's still a path. And this is like my bread and butter of my practice, is working with people getting off of these meds and healing the GABA system in the brain. So it can be done. Absolutely. I witness it every day and it's wonderful. And so you don't need to feel hopeless, but if you're listening and you're about to like start Ambien, then for you, I would say don't.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Oh my goodness. That literally gave me cold chills just hearing you say that on here, because it feels like a mission fulfilling on this original mission that I had when creating Sleep as a Skill all these years back, because when I was in that exact position and in such levels of anxiety and stress and had the prescription and was taking the Ambien to go to sleep overseas and not very much at this weird element of feeling so connected, like this need to have some help, but then knowing that it really wasn't working to the level that it could. I wasn't certainly waking up feeling rested and still so torn as to how to create a future to get off of these. And so to have you on the show right now makes me so happy to be able to spread more of that message for more people, that there is hope around that. And, you know, so for me, that ended up being a huge experience for me of then the process of not taking those anymore and going through all that. So really appreciate that. And then yes, for the group of people that are coming in and are not taking those things, what are some of the approaches that you will work through with them to look at their sleep? So of course, we know many of us speak to CBTI. Is that something that you bring about, or do you kind of have your own approach? How do you kind of look at this?
Yeah. So it's a delight to like treat someone who's not already on meds. Yes. And we just need to fix their
sleep. Totally.
So in a way, I hate this, like it's not really my nature, but I've come to the point where I realize I don't really play well with other psychiatrists and therapists on the playground, because I'm not the biggest advocate of CBTI. I get it. It works. But I don't know, the times I've brought patients through it, I don't know, it can be very difficult. And I guess I just disagree on principle sort of with some of the ways that it works. And I get that it's evidence-based and for some people it's life-changing. But I just like these other methods. And I feel like what happens is that usually all these other things we're about to discuss are actually not exhausted before someone starts CBTI. So it's like we could exhaust these other gentler, easier, very sort of grounded in biologic plausibility for why they work. Do this first while you can still live your life and not be getting 4 hours of sleep every night. Yes. And then maybe CBTI becomes unnecessary. So I guess that brings us to like, well, what the heck do I do with patients?
So
as we mentioned before, light, and I don't want to like bore people with light, but like there are a couple steps within light. So if you just say like, you know, like light, that's not necessarily drawing the concrete steps. So I take a few approaches to light. One is like you need bright light exposure during the day. And so first thing in the morning, you open your shades. If you're commuting, maybe you don't wear sunglasses. You make sure your eyes get the real deal, full bright sunlight at some point during the day, preferably like a lot of it. If you're really like living in a extreme latitude and there just isn't light to be had, and as humans we're not allowed to hibernate apparently, then I think a bright light therapy box, like a 10,000 lux light box, can be a nice intervention in the winter, just to make sure you're getting a good dose of bright light in the morning. And then the real money comes in after sunset. And after sunset is when we are the most, it's been such a departure from how we evolved, and that's where we really need to make a lot of strategic changes. So I kind of separate it out into like beginner, intermediate, and advanced. Not so much like that they're harder, but it's just more involved. So you have to ask yourself, like, to what extent are you suffering and what's worthwhile for you? So there's some things that are just kind of like no big deal, no brainer, low hanging fruit, like have Flux downloaded on your computer, have night shift mode set up on your phone, or night mode if it's an Android device, and just make sure that you're kind of minimizing blue light in ways that don't really bother you. Like Flux is interesting in that you just set it up and it's plug and play and you never have to think about it again. Set it and forget it. It's free software. It transitions your screen to more orange and more dim as the night goes on. If you need to disable it, you can. It's pretty easy to. And then you'll see, I've done this once in a while. If you're like working on something, like I'll be working on a PowerPoint presentation late at night. And then it's like, oh, I can't tell what color this is because it's kind of orangey. And then I'll disable it for an hour. And honestly, you feel like you just like did cocaine.
I can relate to that.
Woo! And you just feel like, okay, let's go gambling all night or something. It's really off to the races. So it just is, it, to me, proof of concept. Like it's such a powerful factor in how awake or sleepy you feel at night is light. And so those are the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
The intermediate step is, I usually in presentations like to do a, like a very goofy visual for this one, which is just to wear blue blocking glasses. There are, there used to be really goofy looking ones. Like I got my UVEX ones on Amazon.
Oh, I had those. Yep.
What are they designed for? I don't know, fly fishing, metallurgy? I never knew, but they look ridiculous. So I still use those because I enjoy looking ridiculous. But now you can spend like $100 and get cool ones that don't look orange. So that's your choice. But I stick to my UVEX ones. I'm trying to like just make a point, I guess.
Yes.
And those are such a nice intervention. It's my favorite kind of health intervention, something that is inexpensive, non-invasive, high potential benefit. It makes sense why it works. To me, the only thing that beats the blue blocking glasses is the squatty potty. And that's an entirely separate conversation.
I love but, so progressive. Fantastic. Or progressive in an ancestral nation.
Exactly.
Conversation. Yeah.
Squat to poop and don't see blue light after sunset. The end. And so basically, yeah, blue blocking glasses are kind of like just run, don't walk, get a pair. They're cheap. They work. And the use case can be different for everyone. For me, I'll wear them maybe the last half an hour or hour before bed, especially if I'm going to look at a screen or read a backlit Kindle in bed. Whereas I have patients who with bipolar illness who are managing their bipolar without medication. And for them, it's a little bit more imperative that they put them on like at sunset and keep them on until bedtime. Because I have a pet theory that bipolar isn't, it's many things. It can be gluten intolerance and thyroid autoimmune disease, but it can also be just sensitivity to light. I think of my bipolar patients as like, if you disabled flux for like someone with bipolar and someone without bipolar, I think the bipolar person is going to be off to the races, and someone who just not at all on that diathesis like won't be as affected. So I think they're just more sensitive to light, so more vulnerable to these aspects of modern life that have us exposed to so much blue spectrum light after sunset. So different use cases for the glasses. And then the last most advanced or like hardcore approaches are like to basically go full Game of Thrones castle in your home and just have it candles, like down to candles for the last half hour before bed is a really great way to see what you're doing, but not disrupt your circadian rhythm. Because I think we evolved seeing moonlight and fire after sunset, so I don't think it disrupts our circadian rhythm. But that don't cause a fire and don't breathe in like toxic, fumey candles. Like get good quality ones. You can do like Good Light, which is a good price point one. Or if you have the money for it, you can get like the bougie ones made of beautiful kinds of like beeswax that was, you know, harvested under a waxing moon. I love those, but they're prohibitively expensive. So they're for once in a while. And then the other option is like a really nice control alt delete on circadian rhythm is to go camping and go camping and like, don't look at your phone, like don't charge your phone, but basically just full on daylight during the day and full on darkness at night. And not to mention that you're grounding and in nature and away from all of the headache of life. And that's a great way if someone's just like, my sleep is, can we curse?
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Like, my sleep is fucked and I don't know how to get out of this hole. Camp for four nights and you're very likely to be in a better spot afterward.
Oh my goodness. I completely agree. And I haven't heard anyone describe it as Game of Thrones. Go all Game of Thrones with our lighting. That is fantastic.
I used to use the analogy of the Boys to Men, I'll Make Love to You video, but I realized like not everyone is 100 years old like me, so it wasn't working.
I love that. That's amazing. Yeah. I'm having multiple things, you know, phrases to pull to give people the visual, the immediate visual of what this would look like. I love that.
Depending on your generation. Yeah,
exactly. Generation dependent. Exactly. Control alt delete to go camping. So well said. Such a great kind of total reset. And then also, of course, taps into that temperature element of things too. And that ability for people to, regulate their mental state through temperature. And actually, I often mention this one gadget that not because of the gadget, but just because of the idea that this one gadget where you put on the on your head like a headband, but it will cool the prefrontal cortex. You've heard of this, that with the idea that our brain, when we have persistent insomnia, is warmer than the average brain. And with that temperature rise, it's more difficult because of that hyper-aroused state while we're in bed, then it's challenging for us to lower to that 2 to 3 degrees to get some of that sleep onset and then eventually solid sleep. Yeah. So this idea of kind of artificially dealing with that, but I think it's fascinating, this idea that our hyper-aroused brain states will disrupt or can disrupt our thermoregulation.
Yeah. I have some theories as to why it happens that way, but that's definitely sort of part of my approach to sleep. It's sort of like light first and then body physiology, which we can talk about in a minute, and then bedroom. And bedroom is so much focused on, you know, make it pitch black dark, whether it's blackout shades or an eye mask, and maybe get a white noise machine if your partner snores or your cat scratches or the garbage truck goes around, like be self-reliant, which is drowning out those interruptions. But then also the temperature and to actually go down to like the mid 60s Fahrenheit so that you're cueing your body for sleep. That's in a way that's simulating the natural world, like you said, with camping. And, you know, you can get really playful with this. Like you can take a hot bath or a hot shower and then go into your 65 degree room. You can get a chili pad. You can get this headband thing. There are ways to do this, or at certain times of year, just open the windows. And that's like a nice economical and environmentally friendly way to do it. And yeah, cooling yourself down before sleep cues the body for sleep. But the reason I think that sometimes people who have a dysregulated circadian rhythm are hotter, I think that a lot of sleep woes are also related to the concept of overtired. I don't know if that's a term people, but your audience is probably familiar with, but I didn't know that concept until I had a kid. And I had a kid and we were struggling with her naps and her sleep. And people were like, oh, she might be getting overtired. And I remember like the first time I heard that, the eye roll I had, I was like, that's not a thing. Like you're tired or you're more tired. Like, but why would she not be sleeping because she's extra tired. So basically, we get overtired when we're perfectly tired at a certain point and our body wants us to go to sleep. And that might look like, you know, falling asleep on the couch. Sound familiar? It's like, yes. We have this sweet spot, this window when our body's super tired. And sidebar, it happens about 3 hours after sunset. That's sort of like the human optimal moment, which varies by season and where you are on the globe. But basically, when we look at remaining hunter-gatherer societies, that's when they're going to sleep. They've kind of agreed upon that independently. They're not like posting it on Twitter. They are off the grid, literally, but they all arrived at this independently, which I find fascinating.
Yeah.
But so a lot of us push past that, because what's 3 hours after sunset? Like in December in the Northern Hemisphere, it's like, you know, 8 p.m. It's very, mm-hmm. sometimes earlier. So it feels egregiously early. You're like, that's not right. Bedtime. That's when I'm getting home from work and starting dinner and then going to go meet friends for cocktails. And then I'll come home and then I'll watch Instagram. And then 1 a.m., that's bedtime. And so when we miss that sweet spot, when we're perfectly tired, our body, the zealous employee that it is, thinks we have a good reason for that. It's like, oh, you didn't go to sleep when you were tired. Maybe because tonight we're on night watch, or this is the Great Migration, or there's a war going on. So it tries to support us and it releases cortisol, our stress hormone, which activates us, which raises our temperature, which makes us feel that tired but wired feeling, because we still have that, what's the term for like that, it's been so long since we've slept. I'm like forgetting the term, but, and so we have that accumulation of like, our body knows we haven't slept in a while. We're tired, but we're also wired because we're now in a stress response. And so basically that I think is how most of us are going to sleep, is in that overtired, tired but wired second wind vibe of cortisol. I know it in myself so well now, is like, I'll be tired and I'll be like, oh, if I went to bed right now, it'd be so cozy and I would fall so deeply asleep. But it seems so early and I still have things to get done and I have to unload the dishwasher and I have to finish this one more thing for work. And then by the time I'm brushing my teeth and going to bed, I feel like that warm second wind feeling and I could like go start projects and work on something all night. And so I think a lot of us are tossing and turning and like pushing against cortisol when we're trying to fall asleep, and it would be solved by going to bed earlier.
Mm.
But like when I think about this, I think about my daughter. When I was learning this, it was like, I'd see these little yawns and I'd be like, that's an emergency. You see your baby yawn. It's like, you got to change that diaper, swaddle that baby and put that pile of dynamite sticks into the crib and get out of there before you miss the window. And suddenly she's overtired and then she's not going to nap. She's not going to fall asleep. You're never going to shower. It's just like, I learned the hard way to catch that window.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, no, I love that relationship to that overtired concept and being mindful of that window. So when you have people coming in, and of course, all, you know, ages and walks of life, and you're discussing this connection from our ancestral mindset and sunrise and sunset and 3 hours per sunset and all these great things, are you met with pushback from people, or are you able to kind of paint the picture of how this could be workable and livable in, you know, 2020 and beyond, and, you know, helping to share how this can all look? And believe me, I have the exact same approach and conversation. I'm just curious how you have worked with people to make this a lifestyle that they believe that they can actually fulfill on.
Yeah, like I think for the purposes of today, I'm just like given all the information. But when I'm meeting a person, I really slow play it. And I'll usually start with like the easier changes to make and then build towards the total life overhaul.
Yes.
So like the physiology. So I think like, you know, blue blocking glasses, and the one piece of light we didn't talk about is getting the phone out of the bedroom, mm-hmm. which is usually where I start with patients actually, because it's so impactful. And it's something you wouldn't necessarily think to do, because we all just like, you know, phones were introduced when? Like 2007, mm-hmm. like the smartphones. And then now it's like, you know, 13 years later and it's our new appendage. And so we all sleep with it on our bedside table. Or like clutch to our chest in the middle of the night.
Yes.
And it's like that. It's so detrimental to sleep on a number of levels. The blue spectrum light is a big part of it, but it's not even all of it, because it also impacts our sleep in terms of our associations with the phone, that it sort of, we think of work email and geopolitical news and online dating, and it's all a bit stimulating and a lot of it's sort of stressful. And then it is also, it's designed to be addictive. It's grabbing our attention. So we miss that sweet spot tired window because we think, let me just take one little glance at whatever it is, TikTok. And then like 40 minutes later, you're like, and like bleary eyed. And you're like, just one more, because they all don't have a natural stopping point. So we just go on and on and on. Right. And also, you know, for people that don't have it on Do Not Disturb, like just the little buzzes and pings overnight can disrupt sleep. And I've had patients who are like, I can't put on Do Not Disturb because what if I get a work email at midnight? Right. And it's like, what if you get a work email at midnight? Like, you're telling me you want to improve your sleep. Then I think it starts with like not responding to work emails at midnight. So, you know, there's sometimes we duke it out a little bit over that. So,
yes.
So then the physiology has some things that are nice to start with as well. Like, I think that people are really receptive to taking magnesium because we're Americans. We want to take a pill to fix something.
Yes.
So I like to talk to people about magnesium glycinate supplementation or taking an Epsom salt bath. There are a lot of great ways to get your magnesium up, and it makes sense. We're just all deficient in magnesium because our food is, because our soil is. So supplementing with this helps with insomnia and headaches and migraines and menstrual cramps and cardiovascular health and digestion and muscle tension, and like, it's safe and makes you live longer and cheap. It's just that you have to do a thing. And so I will sort of start with that. And then people are also often very receptive to keeping blood sugar stable overnight. Mm. And so that's like just pointing out that a lot of middle of the night wake ups are a blood sugar crash until proven otherwise. And so if you can take a, you know, the definitive solution is to keep stable blood sugar around the clock by having a real food diet that's very blood sugar stabilizing and avoiding sugar and refined carbohydrates and alcohol. I leave that last one off sometimes if I'm still trying to win someone over to the force. And then
I love that.
And then even like a hack, like taking a spoonful of almond butter or coconut oil, like right before bed and in the middle of the night, in the event of a wake up, can be really nice for giving you a safety net of blood sugar so that you're not having those blood sugar crash induced stress response wake ups. That's a mouthful. And so that's like something people are receptive to. Once I've got them sleeping a little bit better, phones out of the bedroom, coconut oil before bed, like maybe they've ordered the glasses, only then am I like, okay, now we're going to talk about caffeine and even worse, alcohol. And so those are like further down the road conversations.
Oh my goodness. That's hysterical. to have them join the force. That's so well said. Yeah. And because this is such a large conversation, there's so many things that will impact sleep. I love that you kind of parse it out, you know, based on the listening that you have from the person and where they're at. And I think that's really, really intelligent. And because there are so many things that we can layer in, and then you can start from that top-down approach with the light to begin, and then our environment and all some of these things that are really, you know, that you can create a foundation approach with, getting the phone out of the bedroom and all of those things. It's so wise. When do you move, or do you move into ideas around testing from kind of that functional medicine perspective? Is that something that you touch on with them? And if so, how do you go into that?
That's a good question. So I think I have slightly controversial views on this. I love, like, you know, the functional medicine testing. I do think that there's totally a time and place for that, looking under the hood and getting a sense for what's, you know, just what's going on in the body. But when it comes to like the quantified life of Oura Rings and the sleep cycle app and mats that are measuring your sleep cycles, yes, all these things, I guess if it's working for you, I'm all in favor of it. But I've had a lot of patients who I noticed it kind of created an obsessive relationship and even a little bit of what's called a nocebo effect. So just to explain that, we all know the placebo effect, where it's like, I took this pill and it's supposed to make me happy. Oh, now I'm happy. And it's more of our expectation is influencing the outcome. The converse is the nocebo effect, which is like, I was taking this pill that makes me happy and then I stopped taking it and now I'm unhappy. And what I see with the sleep measuring is that sometimes you wake up and you're like, oh, let me check my app and like see how I slept. And if it's like, you slept great today, good job, Joe, you know, it's like, oh yay, I'm gonna have a good day. But then if you check it and you thought like, I think I slept pretty well last night, and then you look at the app and it's like, no, actually your sleep was shitty last night, I think it can impact your expectations for the day. And it can make you think, I felt kind of rested and okay, but it tells me that I was up all these different times, so I think I will have a lousy day and not be able to focus, and that meeting. So I think for some people, it can have that impact. Not for everyone. For some people, it's incredibly empowering and helps them see the impact of different lifestyle changes. And like, it's totally a tool for the good, for the force, you know,
yes,
for many people. But for some of my patients, I'm just a little cautious about it. Mm-hmm. And there's one other aspect of this, which is just like my witchy feminine approach to health in general, which mm-hmm. is that why do we always have to hand our power over to instruments and objective measurements? Like, we've totally lost the hotline with our own body. Like, mm-hmm. I guess I measure my sleep every day. It's how do I feel today? And like, that's my app. And I think that I guess I just like to empower people to be like really in tune with their own bodies, and that is our best gauge of how we're doing. It tells us all the time in many ways. How did we sleep? Does this food agree with us? Are we getting enough nature and community? Like, our body will tell us what we need.
I love that. And it's such an important place to begin too. That's so wise. And so is that something that also applies to even some of the basically the blood tests or cortisol tests or any of those things too? Do you have the same sort of approach that kind of only go there when we've exhausted all other measures? Is that how you look at it?
To mm-hmm. me, it's like the cortisol testing, I feel like almost always tells us the same piece of information, which is that like a lot of us are dysregulated in our cortisol signaling. So it's like, you know, some people like need to see the objective lab work to be yeah. motivated to make changes. Other people, it's just like, we're going to make the same changes regardless. So it doesn't really change management, but for mm-hmm. some people, it changes motivation. But it's like, yes, let's protect your circadian rhythm and get your body in sync with the sun and the moon, whether or not we test it. And same kind of goes with blood sugar. It's like, to me, the even less invasive way to do that is take a spoonful of coconut oil. How'd you sleep? Like, did that help you not wake up? And so, yeah, I guess I just like these low tech approaches, yeah. but I don't hate it when people do the testing. I just feel like we have low tech ways of achieving the same outcome.
Oh, I love that. No, it's really, and you're clearly well-versed on, you know, some of these foundational things that will really make such a profound difference. And I can't overstate how much I think this is so important that people like you are singing, you know, yelling this from the rooftops, the importance of bringing this in into the conversation. It's just amazing. And so I'd imagine that you've certainly piqued the interest for many people to learn more about you. So I'm curious to hear, one, how they can learn more about you, how they could work with you, how they can follow you, all of those things.
Yeah, I'm all over the internet. I'm ellenvora.com and I'm at ellenvoramd on Instagram and Twitter and even TikTok now.
Wow, nice. Oh God. Progressive.
boomer on TikTok. And then like I'm on Facebook, I don't know, ellenvoramd, I think. And so how does Facebook even work? It seems unclear to me what my handle is there.
Yes, it's a little confusing.
So Google my name and it'll get yes. you there. And and I do online groups. I'm going to start them back up in the fall, and I'm writing a book on anxiety, which my editor will try to make not entirely about sleep. But as you can all tell, I have a lot to say about sleep. So expect about a good 100 pages on sleep.
Yes. Awesome. And what did the groups look like? So if people are interested in joining, is that something so they can sign up to learn more on your website and you run those regularly?
Yeah. Oh, they're the best. I mean, I cry like every other group. They're so moving. Aww. But basically it's nice. Like, I have my private practice, which is waitlisted till forever. But that's like me and one person. But the group is this much more accessible, affordable option. And it is, I don't know, the community element makes a big difference. So you feel like you're not alone. You feel witnessed and held in community. And we basically, I keep them pretty small. It's usually like maybe 10 people. And we process for an hour and a half once a week for 4 weeks and cover holistic approaches to mental health topics, but also just check in and talk about everything on people's minds and what comes up. That's usually where the best stuff comes up, is in people's questions and troubleshooting. And it's really pretty special. And we do like weird, like shamanic shaking practices and things like that, just to keep things weird.
I love that brand value. I so support that. Let's keep it weird, folks. Okay. That's awesome. Wow. Okay, great. And so And also all these resources can be found on your website. So all the things are available there, and you have free guides and all kinds of resources there from the looks of it too, as well. Okay, awesome. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your wisdom and, you know, really being a force, a part of the force for, you know, this really holistic approach that I foresee being much more in the future a common thing to look to. But right now you're part of the pioneers. So really great to see.
Cool. You too, Molly. Thanks for doing the work you do.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And we'll have to have a part two in the future. There's, you know, when you get that book out, that's going to be awesome. Can't wait to read that.
Cool.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
You've been listening to the Sleep is a Skill podcast, the number one podcast for people who want to take their sleep skills to the next level. Every Monday, I send out something that I call Molly's Monday Obsessions, containing everything that I'm obsessing over in the world of sleep. Head on over to sleepisaskill.com to sign up.